In the 19th century, the most widely acclaimed account of George Whitefield came from not from one of his biographers, but from the memoirs of one of his assistants. The volume was written by Cornelius Winter, 1742 to 1807, an evangelical dissenting minister. Upon its publication in 1808, the memoir was a great success. Not only was a portrayal of Whitefield included, but Winter was an interesting character in of himself who had occasion to be in contact with most of the well-known early English evangelicals. To top it off, his autobiography was edited with additional thoughts by Winter's former student, the Reverend William Jay of Bath, considered one of the foremost preachers of the early 19th century. The Methodist minister, J.B. Blakely, who authored The Prince of Pulpit Orators, a portraiture of the Reverend George Whitefield, wrote, "To Mr. Winter, we are indebted for the best portraiture ever given of Whitefield, of his habits, his peculiarities as a preacher, as well as many anecdotes illustrative of his character and history. No one ever had a better opportunity to know him. None have better described him." And the English poet laureate, Robert Southey, said of Winter's book, "This volume contains a much more interesting account of Whitefield than is to be found in any life of him that has yet been published." It is not at all surprising that Whitefield was a prominent subject in Winter's personal testimony, for after all, it was Whitefield who led the man to Christ and set his course into ministry. But what was surprising was that Winter also revealed many of the great evangelist's weaknesses and pitfalls, which later biographers would have to contend with in subsequent years. The question remains as to why, more than 35 years after the revivalist's death, Cornelius Winter revealed so many of Whitefield's flaws, which was highly unusual in comparison with the hagiographical writings of the time period. This paper will offer a brief description of the life and ministry of Cornelius Winter, seek to examine the credibility of the man as a critic, present the criticism itself, and conclude with a possible motivation for the biographer's sharp evaluation of George Whitefield. Cornelius Winter had a humble beginning. Born in London, Winter's parents died at an early age. He was forced to live in a workhouse for several years before he was apprenticed to his uncle, an alcoholic who physically abused him throughout most of his service. As a young man, Winter felt, quote, "a very strong prejudice against the Methodists and dissenters." But his views changed after the first time he heard George Whitefield in 1760. He was distinctly moved by the evangelical preaching and felt, even despite a large crowd, that the evangelist was speaking directly to him, though he was 60 feet away. However, it did not keep him from mocking Whitefield's emotional style of preaching while playing cards among his friends. And at the time, he was smartly reproved by a Scotswoman who advised him that he should read the 8th chapter of Romans before he disrespected the preacher again. Through the incident, the young man felt the sting of the rebuke and said it was the moment that awakened his need for the scriptures, because he had no clue what the 8th chapter of Romans said. Winter could not point to one specific event in which he was converted. He merely stated that he sat under the preaching of Whitefield at the Tabernacle and Tottenham Court Chapel in London for 5 years until his conversion. Winter attributed the delay to the weakness of Methodist preaching at the chapels when the revivalist was absent, which was also a veiled criticism of Whitefield's leadership, which will be explored later in the paper. He stated, aside from Whitefield, quote, "the supplies were not very considerable." In 1766, though uneducated, Winter felt the call to preach himself. It was related to hearing the stories from Whitefield's exploits in America and the colony's need for evangelical preaching. Encouraged by John Berridge, Winter sought Whitefield's patronage. Eventually, the revivalist accepted him on a trial basis in February 1767. The young man worked hard to make himself very useful to the elder minister. From that point on, he wrote, "I became one of the family, slept in the room of my honored patron, and had the privilege to sit at his table." Though opportunities presented themselves to go to America through Whitefield's connections, Winter was never offered placement. It also disturbed him that his mentor had not worked to have him ordained in the established church. The young protege suspected he had made himself too valuable in the personal service of his patron, and that Whitefield preferred to keep him by his side. When Whitefield planned his final trip to America in 1769, Winter accompanied the revivalist in the hopes of securing orders by becoming a chaplain to the black population of Georgia. "I only knew I was bound for Georgia," he wrote, "and that I was going to teach the Negroes the way of salvation." In return for his service, Whitefield pledged his support to have him ordained. But his mentor had also withheld information from him until he was on the passage to Savannah. "He told me what he had concealed while on the English shore, that if I had as many to preach to as his bed cabin would hold, I might think myself well off, and that I might expect to be whipped off the plantation when I had done." Upon arrival, the elder minister headed north for preaching engagements, while Winter remained in Georgia to work among the slaves. The revivalist prediction turned out to be true. While Winter had considerable success among the black population, the majority of the white planters opposed him. They referred to him disparagingly as the Negro parson. Winter bolstered on in his ministry despite the insinuations and impositions. When Whitfield died in Massachusetts later that September, Winter was entrusted with the return of the evangelist Will to London. The young man also hoped ordination would improve his situation when he returned to the colonies. Upon arrival in England in 1771, he discovered the damage done to his reputation through letters to the Bishop of London from leading planters and clergymen in America. Still called to the ministry, but with no hope of ordination, Winter became a dissenting itinerant in southwest England, among the Calvinist Methodist chapels connected to Whitfield and the Countess of Huntingdon, two of which he planted himself. Marrying Miriam Brown on the 21st of April in 1779, he eventually settled into a pastorate at Marlborough in Wiltshire. Winter saw a great need for training evangelical ministers. He opened his Marlborough Academy at some point between late 1779 to early 1780. It was financially supported by Thomas Hancock, a gentleman of the town, and the Anglican philanthropist John Thornton of Clapham. Later, the academy would move to Panswick, Gloucestershire, in 1791. In addition to those preparing for the ministry, he also took in students training for secular professions. He and his wife had as many as 70 children at one time. The Hancocks of Marlborough, who pioneered innovations in the rubber industry, were two of these pupils. But the primary activity was the training of pastors. This became his life's work. Some of these ministers became quite prominent, such as William J. of Bath and John Griffin of Portsea, both of whom were keynote speakers at the annual meetings of the London Missionary Society. Winter would continue this endeavor until his death in 1807. Within two decades of his death, Winter's students occupied a third of the pulpits in Gloucestershire independent chapels. His academy became his life's work. Winter's credibility as a witness to Whitfield's life was unimpeachable. He had an outstanding reputation as an able minister and for telling the truth. He lived in near poverty as he and his wife made all their worldly possessions available to the poor of the community. He tirelessly visited the sick and the infirm to comfort their souls. He toiled to make sure the pulpits of many smaller village chapels were supplied with evangelical preaching. His students remarked how attentive he was to his wife and set a pure example for them in marriage. Evangelical philanthropists such as John Thornton, Sir Richard Hill, and Sir Charles Middleton entrusted him with large sums of money to distribute to the poor. And at one point, he collected funds to give Roland Hill a horse in order to fulfill his itinerancy during the period when his family disowned him. When William Jay mentioned to John Wesley that he was a former student of Cornelius Winter, despite his tutor being a staunch Calvinist, Wesley responded, "Cornelius is an excellent man." Winter's personal life was above reproach. Even in being known as a meek and gentle man, Winter had the penchant of always being truthful. He was never intimidated in telling the truth, no matter the station of the person to whom he offered it. When William Jay first became a popular orator while filling Roland Hill's pulpit in London, Winter immediately wrote to Jay to warn him of the dangers of pride, and advised him to leave the city immediately so as not to be enamored with accolades that he was receiving. In declaring his intentions to his future wife, Winter explicitly forewarned her that their life would be a difficult one in the service of the Lord. At times, he rebuked congregants for sin, yet he still loved them despite their continued anger at him. He rebuked a wealthy patron for not contributing enough to the poor of the community. He wrote to a man who attempted suicide to warn him of 1 John 3:15, "No murderer hath eternal life in him." On at least one occasion, he contended with no less a personality than the Countess of Huntingdon when she had unnecessarily wronged her Bristol ministers. He also appeared honest in representing himself about his own weaknesses. With candor, he admitted the deadness that seized his soul and the cloud that overspread his understanding as he fumbled through his first sermon. He was honest enough to confess the occasions when he entered the pulpit unprepared. When he had to solicit funds for the debt of his chapel building, he wrote to a friend, quote, "I feel mortified in being the beggar. My pride is often humbled by unbecoming repulse and by the ungracious manner in which some grant the request of my lips," end quote. When his bodily health declined in later years, he acknowledged his need to his church at Panswick, knowing it would be a financial burden upon them. In both his character and his truthfulness, Cornelius Winter exemplifies a credible witness. In dealing with the criticisms of Whitfield, two remarks must be made. First, Winter was aware that his former student, William Jay, was gathering material in order to edit and to publish his memoirs. Winter first encountered Whitfield's preaching in 1760, and thereafter became acquainted with his connections at the Tabernacle and Tottenham Court Chapel soon afterwards. However, Winter was only intimate with the revivalists for the final 4 years of his life. So the younger man only had familiar access to the evangelist after age 50. But despite the short period of time, the Whitfield years played a significant part of his autobiographical account, taking up 10 of the 17 chapters that Winter wrote. These years had a tremendous impact on the direction and formation of his ministry, which cemented his convictions regarding Calvinism, evangelicalism, and nonconformity. It is only natural that Winter would focus most of the attention of this period of his life. Second, the vast majority of how Whitfield influenced Winter is portrayed in a positive light. There are only a handful of critical remarks throughout the book, but chapter 8 contains the harshest criticism that most of Whitfield's later biographers felt the need to defend. And even in these remarks, Winter offered excuses for his patron. The censures contained in this chapter were instigated at the request of William Jay. Jay had written to Winter and asked him for the details of the private character of the great evangelist, as at the time, they were unknown. Winter added these at his insistence, and within a footnote of the final 1843 edition of Winter's memoir, Jay accepted full responsibility for including these remarks, even when many of his colleagues wished they had been omitted. So it was never Winter's intention to write a scathing account of his mentor's life, but only to provide an honest report of what transpired. So what were the criticisms that Winter directed towards Whitfield? Well, these can be summarized into three categories. First, that Whitfield set a poor example for younger ministers. Second, that he had a contentious personality. And third, that the evangelist was negligent in the training and preparation of ministers within his connection. With the first, Winter stated that his mentor, quote, was not a fit person for a young man in humble circumstances to be connected with, end quote. He disapproved of his elder's lack of preparation in preaching. He wrote that Whitfield never gave any indication of, quote, the importance of being habituated to the planning of a sermon, spending only an hour or two before he entered the pulpit with Clark's Bible, Matthew Henry's commentary, and Cruden's concordance. Winter believed the published sermons that Whitfield carefully prepared were easily distinguishable from those that were not and transcribed by journalists of the day. In comparison to this, he felt that his mentor spent too much time in the writing of his polemical pamphlets, where he would sequester himself for long periods of time. Winter wished he would have devoted more time to his sermons. In contrast to this, while admiring Whitfield's delivery as a preacher overall, the excesses of Whitfield's emotionalism in the pulpit at times disturbed him. I could hardly bear such unreserved use of tears and the scope he gave to his feelings, he wrote. For sometimes he exceedingly wept, stamped loudly and passionately, and was so frequently overcome that for a few seconds you would suspect he would never recover. And when he did, nature required some little time to compose herself. He criticized Whitfield's relationship to his wife. He stated, quote, he was not happy in his wife. And while acknowledging he did not intentionally make his wife unhappy, he allowed other poor examples to influence him in his relationship to her. Winter wrote that her death set his mind much at liberty. For all of these reasons, Winter thought Whitfield was a poor example to young ministers. With the second criticism, that he was contentious, upon being first engaged in Whitfield's service, he said, quote, he was received with both kindness and severity, not certain which would be directed towards him. Winter wrote that he was impatient of contradiction, and because of this, he left himself and his orphanage in Georgia vulnerable to men who sought his favor by humoring his weakness and letting him act and speak without contradiction. Whitfield took great liberties with those that served under him, often underpaying them. Winter wrote, his maxim was, if you love me, you will serve me disinterestedly. Hence, he settled no certain income, or a very slender one, upon his dependents. Whitfield demanded his meals at a precise time and would become irritable with just the slightest delay. Winter recorded an instance of when his elder lashed out at a servant for being late, who was striving to please his master. On another occasion, when someone disappointed him, the revivalist lamented, how could you do so? I would not have served you so. He particularly was too severe with young people and took opportunities to humiliate them with menial tasks in order to, quote, curb the vanity of human nature. Winter frequently found Whitfield to be a difficult personality. And with the third criticism, Winter revealed that his master did not seek to prepare the ministers in his connection. Upon entering the ministry, Whitfield noticed Winter's deficiencies in learning. He wrote, he, meaning Whitfield, showed himself much dissatisfied with my writing and orthography, both of which certainly stood in need of correction. His patron sent him for a few hours of instruction in Latin grammar each day to John Green, a clergyman who was a tutor and assistant to Whitfield at the Tottenham Court Chapel, while at the same time continuing to have Winter serve in the pulpit. But Whitfield curtailed the young man's education by requiring a close attention to his own business, mainly reading the prayers and conducting funerals, despite not being ordained. Winter wrote, quote, a single quarter year closed my school exercise, in which I'm ashamed but constrained to say I hardly gained knowledge enough to decline Musa. He surmised, it was plain Mr. Whitfield did not intend to promote my literary improvement. Winter even questioned the tutors that Whitfield put over his charges. It was the practice of John Green, who was responsible for the bulk of training ministers in Whitfield's connection, to conduct among the young preachers prophecy nights in the manner of the Quakers based upon his interpretation of 1 Corinthians 14. Winter also noted that Green and the Reverend Richard Elliott, who also assisted at the Tottenham Court Chapel, lapsed from Trinitarian orthodoxy after debating in Arian and Sabellian, respectively. It was Winter's estimation that too many young men were either untested or thrust into their ministries without adequate preparation. Poor example, churlishness, and a dereliction of training were the charges Winter aimed at Whitfield. The accusations made by Winter were serious enough that each of Whitfield's subsequent biographers felt led to deal with them in either praise of Winter's frankness or to justify his mentor's actions. While praising the character of Cornelius Winter with quotes from the contemporaries who knew him, Robert Philip, who wrote The Life and Times of George Whitfield, argued that Winter was only present for 2 years of Whitfield's marriage prior to his wife's death. He believed that was not enough time to assess Whitfield's relationship to her, and that, quote, Winter must be deemed, for once, rash at least, in this accusation. In his biography of Christian leaders, J.C. Ryle praised the emotional outburst from Whitfield, reported by Winter, as the preacher's passionate pleading for souls. And Arnold Dallimore did include all of Winter's criticisms in the second of his massive two-volume biography. But he deduced, quote, it must be recognized that Winter's report does not refer to Whitfield in his prime years, but only to a very short period towards the close of his years of weakness. Winter's insight into Whitfield was formidable enough that it had to be dealt with by other biographers. But on the other hand, it must also be remembered that Winter had more praise for his mentor than criticism. Even while making these disparaging remarks, he still referred to Whitfield as his ever-honored and dear friend and father. And with the exceptions already noted, he praised Whitfield's power in the pulpit. Of it, he said, my intimate knowledge of him admits of my acquitting him of the danger of affectation. To his own pupil, William Jay, Winter prayed that, like Whitfield, quote, a large measure of the spirit which he spake may rest upon you. And here lies the key to the reason Winter revealed such intimate details about Whitfield's shortcomings. All biographies have a purpose in telling their stories. J.C. Ryle hoped his biographical account of 18th century evangelical churchmen would inspire a new generation of 19th century Anglican ministers. Dallimore hoped for the same from nonconformists in the 20th century with his portrayal of Whitfield. He not only wanted to hold up the great evangelist as a personal example, but also promote Calvinism over and above Arminianism of Wesley. Dallimore writes, I sought to show the doctrines used of God in the 18th century revival and to display the extraordinary fervor which characterized the men whom God raised up in that blessed work. And Harry Stout wanted to promote the revivalist as a precursor of marketplace evangelism, that Whitfield used his dramatic gifts to compete with the theater by entertaining from the pulpit. Winter is no different with his presentation of Whitfield in his memoir. It served a purpose. It must stay in the forefront that when Winter wrote his account, he was essentially telling his own story. He wrote of the things that profoundly made impressions upon him, both good and bad, both the things that inspired him and the pitfalls he wished to avoid, characteristics that he wished to pass along to or omit from the next generation of evangelical preachers of the revival that Whitfield began. The younger man pressed on to serve the pulpits of Whitfield's connection by providing them with suitable supplies. He never wavered from Whitfield's ecumenical spirit, his Calvinistic convictions, or that preaching was the primary means of communicating the gospel. And yet Winter went out of his way to demonstrate kindness and encouragement to his students. They all praised his treatment of them and the personal example that he set. Not one of them mentioned an occasion where he demeaned them. Unlike the challenge of trying to placate his mentor, his students thought differently of him. It was a privilege, Jay said, rather than a task, to do anything before him. Jay evaluated his schoolmaster by saying he was a father with sons rather than a tutor with his students. And two of his other former students also used the term father in describing their former teacher. His own marriage and family life was such a model to his students that they desired to emulate him. He accepted rebukes and the advice of those who challenged him. And of course, he devoted his life educating men for the ministry who would be devoted to the local church, most of whom had unusually long tenures in their pulpits. He wanted to provide suitable ministers to sustain the revival within Whitfield's connection. Before entering the academy, Winter wrote to William Jay, quote, "You will not forget the object we have in view. It is to prepare you for and introduce you into the service of the sanctuary, in which service that you act properly and shine for the glory of God." In summing up Winter's influence as a tutor, Jay wrote, "The preservation of spirituality is of great importance where the office is sacred. Of this, Mr. Winter never lost sight. He was always feeding and cherishing the piety, as well as promoting the literary improvement of those that served under his care. He constantly reminded them of the absolute necessity of personal religion and endeavored to keep alive their sense of dependence upon God." Winter's reason for presenting the negative of Whitfield was so that he could improve upon the evangelicalism of his day, not derail it. By revealing the details of his mentor's weaknesses, in addition to his own, his purpose was not so that the bar may be set lower, but that in viewing the real person rather than the legend, one can see that God works through his ministers despite their weaknesses, and yet those weaknesses should be improved upon. Winter had made a significant step in moving away from the hagiography of the 18th century and providing an honest assessment of his master's life, that George Whitfield was a mere man used by God. Years after Winter's memoir was published, Jay wrote that his friend, Roland Hill, had said he was not satisfied with Mr. Winter's account, and he thought he had not done justice to Mr. Whitfield. But his other friend, William Wilberforce, responded differently. He said, "It is fact we want in biography and not fiction. The sacred writers, our best models, are always impartial, and in their pictures we have shade as well as light." And Wilberforce added with firmness, "With regard to myself, I must confess that upon the whole, Mr. Winter has raised instead of lowering Whitfield in my estimation." It would appear that Winter's purpose was accomplished. He presented his mentor in such a light that it was God and not George Whitfield that received the glory.